Bismillah, alhamdulillah, wassalatu wassalam ala rasulillah amma ba'd. I'm going to start as Muslims do, in the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful. So, what I'm going to be speaking about today is Darwinian evolution a fact? Like with most things in life, you have to define what you mean. So if you mean by fact, it is certain, it is absolute, it's not going to change, it's the same as if the earth is going around the sun, then Darwinian evolution, defined that way, is absolutely not a fact. If you define it a fact as something which is generally agreed upon in science, or it's the best theory available for the data that we currently have, then there's nothing really wrong with calling it a scientific fact from that perspective. And as I'm going to be showing today, firstly, science is revisable, meaning its conclusions can change. Darwinism is not an exception. If you're going to argue Darwinian mechanism or Darwinian evolution is an absolute fact, then it's no longer scientific, it's actually pseudoscience. And thirdly, I'm going to be going over some problems for the mechanism. Okay, so the very first thing we're going to go over is a very brief, and I'm going to emphasize this, a very brief review of the philosophy of science. So, firstly, imagine all your life, the only swans that you've seen are white. And every other person that you know, every swan that they have seen is white. And from this limited set of observations, you make the general proposition, all swans are white. And one day, you come across a black swan, and that overrides your previous theory. You can call this the black swan problem, or as the philosopher David Hume put it, it's the problem of induction. But this is a very well-known, well-understood problem in the philosophy of science. Now, what does that actually mean? Does that actually mean we can't have any knowledge? We can't be certain of anything? Of course not. We use induction every single day. All it means is we need to be humble with our conclusions. So remember, science is based upon induction, observation. You take a limited set of observations and you conclude for the general. And as new data comes, you have to revise your previous conclusions. Also, and this is very, very important, any set of data can fit many different theories. Okay, that's a very important point to understand. And this is in every field, in physics, chemistry, biology, wherever you look, any set of data can fit many different theories. And what scientists do is they apply some methods, they have, inference to the best explanation. That's one way that they try and get the data that fit, the theory that fits the best data. So there's two essential problems. Number one, new data can come across, which will totally go against your previous theory, or there are many different ways that you can use the existing data to come up with different theories. So, if you pick up any book on the philosophy of science, you'll get, philosophers saying, look, every single scientific theory 50 years ago in chemistry, biology, physics, is very different to what we have today, and extremely different to what we had 100 years ago. And also that science is revisable. So all of its conclusions are provisional. And philosophers of science would actually say is, it's actually very dangerous to use words like proof and even fact. I mean, of course, if you define it in an absolute way, it's very dangerous. Another important proposition is falsification. So every single scientific theory has to be in principle falsifiable. Now, what does that mean? That means you should be able to conceive of some evidence that will go against it. Now, a very simple way to put it is the way Einstein put it. no amount of experimental results can ever prove my theory right. One can prove it wrong. So science doesn't technically prove, it disproves. Science has the best models for the data, and then you're going to come across some data which is going to go against your previous conclusion, and you're going to falsify it. Now, this is, again, not a radical idea, not a something which I just took out of my briefcase or whatever. This is a very well-known problem in the philosophy of science. I'm just going to mention a very crude way that people in popular culture look at science. They're like, how can you say science is uncertain when computers compute? If you base medicine on science, you cure people. If you design rockets based upon science, they go to the moon. So science works, and because it works, and because of all the benefits that we have, it's actually certain. Now, this is actually a very silly argument. Just because something works doesn't mean it's certain. The reason why science works is because its conclusions are revisable, because its conclusions are provisional. Now, I'm just going to go over a simple example. Imagine this is your car, which I'm guessing, being students in Coventry University, that's highly unlikely. So this is your car, and you have some boosters. You have nitrogen boosters for your car, and you go really, really fast. Now, nitrogen was discovered using something known as the phlogiston theory, which was a theory in chemistry, which was very well accepted by scientists, by chemists. They called it a scientific fact. And later, we discovered phlogiston didn't actually exist. But this theory, even though it was very successful, it produced new data, it made predictions which came true, and it helped us discover nitrogen, it was actually false. So just because something works doesn't mean it is certain. Okay, this has stopped working, and that is maybe proof of my point. I think I'm going to have to press this. There we go. Okay, what you also get is you know, when we speak about evolution and Darwinism, you get these very, I would call them science popularizers, or as other biologists have called them, you know, science journalists, people like Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss and these other guys. And they talk about science as if, you know, there's a united community of scientists and they are at the forefront and they are the spokespeople for all these invisible scientists behind them. But most of the time, these guys are just science popularizers, and they don't understand basic things about the philosophy of science and basic things sometimes about their own field. So you'd hear these really silly things like, if you don't believe in evolution, don't take medicine, because medicine is based upon evolution. And an example of that is, you know, bacteria evolving. You know, every couple of years we have to develop a new forms of medicine, new antibiotics. Why? Because bacteria evolve and they become resistant to it, right? And you get superbugs. So they say, this is evolution, and medicine is based upon this, so if you don't believe in evolution, don't take medicine. Okay, there's quite a few problems with here. Number one, as I'm going to show later, there's a word game being played. It's bait and switch, right? Speaking about evolution in the same way that you speak about Darwinism, right? The other thing is, just because something works doesn't mean it's true. Third thing, and this is very, very interesting. Actually, I'm going to save that point for later, because there's actually a cartoon which helps you visualize what's actually going on when people make these remarks. So we get this media narrative that the Darwinian mechanism, it was discovered 150 years ago, and since then, the only people that resisted Darwin was, you know, religious people, and it was a very successful theory at his time. From him till now, you know, it's produced so much results, so much medicine has been discovered on it, and it's the absolute fact. And you get all these documentaries on it, you get, you know, very popular figures like David Attenborough speaking about it, you get these very interesting descriptions and pictures on YouTube, on in textbooks. But the truth is, Is this all smoke and mirrors, or is the theory actually absolutely true? Now, the first thing I want you guys to realize is, ignoring all the science, just looking into the philosophy of science, you know that can't be the case. Because the philosophy of science teaches us every single scientific theory, in principle, has to be falsifiable, so you can't claim certainty. Also, the history of science has shown us every single prevailing theory in chemistry, biology, and physics is different to what it was 50 years ago, 20 years ago, 100 years ago. Why? Because of the problem of induction, because of falsification, and because of the fact that data can fit many different theories. So when you hear something like, it's absolutely safe to say, if you meet someone who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane. Now, anybody like a very well-known person like Richard Dawkins, when he says that to you, or says that to the public, you would think this thing has to be true if he has that much proof. But as we're going to see later, even he acknowledges that, you know, it can change, it can modify. In fact, you can even get rid of it. And new data can come, and you can have, you know, a completely different theory of evolution. And the interesting thing is, there's a geneticist at Harvard, Richard Lewontin, and what he basically says is, in a lecture called DNA as Dogma, he says most of the medicine that we have today is not based on actual science. It's actually based on trial and error. So when you get past all the media narratives, when you get past all the science popularizers, the science journalists like Richard Dawkins, you actually get to see it's actually not as certain as people claim it is. So imagine you're in a lecture theater like we are in right now, and you're listening to a lecturer, and the lecturer speaks about the fossil record, he speaks about you know, genetics, he speaks about DNA, speaks about all these different topics, and he says the Darwinian mechanism is absolute truth, whoever denies it is an idiot, and he, you know, just goes on a rant about how Darwin was so successful. And you actually say, well, you know, I can accept it as a working model, but I think Darwinism is actually very speculative. I think it's based on a lot of assumptions, and I think there's actually disputes on the data that we actually have. And even the history of Darwinism, we had something known as the eclipse of Darwinism, you know, between Darwin's death and what's known as the modern synthesis. You know, a lot of biologists were ignoring natural selection as the main driving force of evolution. And, you know, you basically emphasize these three terms. And I think these three terms are what I want to stick to today. And it makes a nice acronym as well, SAD. Speculation, assumptions, and disputes. Now, what do you think his reaction's going to be if you actually, at the end of a three-hour lecture, when he goes over all this evidence for Darwinism, you turn around and you say, actually, it's very speculative, it's based on assumptions, and there's a lot of disputes on the data. You might hear something like, how dare you, or you're being anti-scientific. What's really interesting is, as I'm going to show, all of these things which I just said and the terms that I'm using are actually used by mainstream secular biologists. So here's the terms of engagement for, and I actually took this term from Jerry Fodor, the philosopher of science's book on what Darwin got wrong. What I found really interesting is whenever you find a philosopher, you know, arguing against a particular scientific theory, you wouldn't really find the philosopher, you know, begging or groveling in front of people and saying, you know, please don't hurt me, I'm an atheist just like you, I'm also carrying a atheist card, I'm a dye-in-the-wool atheist, you know. And you write a chapter called Terms of Engagement before you actually challenge Darwin. I found that very interesting because it shows you the sort of social pressure which has been created around this theory. Why would a respectable academic, an atheist, a philosopher of science, have to write a chapter calming down neo-Darwinists before he actually argues against the theory? So, terms of engagement. Nothing I'm going to say today is going to come from anyone who believes in, you know, intelligent design, creationism, whatever you want to call it, secular, mainstream. They believe in naturalism, so they believe in the naturalistic framework. They're not going to invoke any metaphysical entity to explain science. And what I'm going to be mentioning is going to be from peer-reviewed journals. And what's really interesting, I have a picture of a Japanese scientist whose name I actually forgotten. He's got a tough name to remember. And again, he's a secularist, he's a mainstream academic, and he actually says he doesn't believe in the Darwinian mechanism as it's taught in textbooks. And what he actually says is very interesting. He says Darwin is a god in biology. That's the kind of language that some secular academics are actually using when it comes to Darwin. So we're dealing with more than just the science here. You have a picture here of Lynn Sagan. She tried to publish her end symbiotic theory in the 1960s. She had to go through more than 10 peer-reviewed journals, and they all refused her. They refused to publish her work. And now her theory is taught in every single university in the world, including Coventry University. Right? She's an atheist. She's a biologist. She doesn't believe in neo-Darwinism. She calls it a religion. Right? That just goes to show you the pressure and the fact that there's some philosophical assumptions behind Darwinism, which you don't see in the documentaries, which you don't see on National Geographic, which you don't see in the textbooks. And interestingly enough, Thomas Huxley's grandson, Julian Huxley, in 1959, 100 years after the publication of The Origin of Species, he proclaimed Darwinism as a universal religion for mankind, right? So whether it's atheist biologists like Lynn Sagan who are against the Darwinian mechanism, or it's people who are very important in the modern synthesis like Julian Huxley, they both agree on one thing at least when it comes to Darwinism. It's definitely more than science. It is a philosophical worldview. Okay, now, because Jerry Fodor had to have his own terms of engagement, which I agreed with, he still got attacked. He got called a secular creationist. And because of that and other reasons, I actually have my own terms of engagement, which I've called the neo-Darwinian self-defense, right? So firstly, the claim that you get as soon as you challenge Darwinism as a mechanism is, oh, you're being anti-scientific. You're going to hear this all the time. You're being anti-scientific. That's actually not true, because science, all of its conclusions are provisional. You're not going to hear that from Richard Dawkins, obviously. You're probably going to hear that from a philosopher of science. And look, most people don't, they know of Richard Dawkins, they know of Jerry Coyne, they know of Lawrence Krauss, they know of these people, but they wouldn't know of, say, the senior editor of Nature, the biologist, Henry Gee. He's an atheist as well. They wouldn't know him. Even though in the field, he's much more respected than someone like Dawkins would be. And even he agrees in his book, Misunderstandings of Human Evolution, that all scientific conclusions are provisional. They can be nothing else. So if someone claims you're being anti-scientific, remind them what science is. Bait and switch word games. You're going to hear this all the time. You want proof of evolution? You want proof that there's common ancestry between humans and apes? Well, look at Lenski's bacterial experiment. Look at the peppered moth examples of Catwell. So you're going to get this bait and switch. They're speaking about something else. They're trying to prove something else. And they use language as they use manipulative language to actually prove their point. I was speaking to a biologist, a neo-Darwinist, and I basically said that there's a difference between the fact of evolution, if you want to call it, and the Darwinian mechanism. You know, it's not the same thing. And he said, technically, you're right. There's a difference between the fact of evolution and the Darwinian mechanism. But I use them interchangeably because they're pretty much the same thing. Now, that's a really interesting admission, and we're going to see later why. You're going to hear loads of technical jargon as a form of self-defense, but all you have to do is question, okay, this particular thing that you just said to me, there are, I don't know, certain amount of smell genes in the human genome which are switched off, right? And this is a proof of something, okay? All you can simply ask them is that conclusion certain? Will that ever change? Is that interpretation the only possible interpretation of the data? That's all you have to do. And everything that I'm saying today, I'm not coming up with any new scientific theory. I'm not giving my own views on anything. I'm just simply making a simple logical point. The philosophy of science teaches us every single scientific conclusion is provisional. Okay, you don't have a PhD. If you are going to question the neo-Darwinian mechanism, the first thing you're going to hear is, but you don't have a PhD, you're not a biologist. Okay, or you could simply say to them, okay, there's other people who have PhDs who are biologists, who are professors and so forth, who do think neo-Darwinism is nonsense, is a religion. Lynn Sagan, James Shapiro, loads of others. Well, not majority definitely don't. And the same biologist who I was speaking to, he said to me, for every one biologist you bring me that believes neo-Darwinism's wrong, I'll bring you 1,000 which believe it's true. What's wrong with that line of reasoning? Is science a democracy? Is it a numbers game? Is it a social construct? I've got this many scientists, therefore my theory is more correct than yours. That brings me on to the next point, which is consensus. Oh, there's a consensus on the Darwinian mechanism. Okay, assuming there is, assuming every single biologist that ever lived from the time of Darwin till today agreed the neo-Darwinian mechanism is correct and true. Does that mean it's certain? No, because of the philosophy of science, because of the history of science. And obviously, there's not consensus. You're going to hear, you don't understand science, but it works. Only religious people object. There's no naturalistic explanations, and so on and so on. And like I said previously, even though Richard Dawkins says, if you don't believe in Darwinism, you're either ignorant, stupid, or insane, he actually agrees in his book, A Devil's Chaplain, that, you know, new data can come that we drop Darwinism or we modify it beyond recognition. That's just a very small admission that he makes. So even he realizes, you know, science can change. And remember, if you look at something from a very short period, it looks, you know, it's true, it's not going to change. But if you look at science over a longer period, you'll find things always change. So there is a big difference between evolution and Darwinism. Evolution, you know, the biologist David the way he defines it is, you know, it's change in organisms over time. There's many different definitions, but there's evolution as a observation, or evolution as a fact, if you want to call it, and there is the mechanism, and maybe a history of evolution that comes with the Darwinian mechanism. So these two are two very different things. So just a brief recap of what is Darwinism. There are different models, but I'm going to go over the most popular model, which is, you know, LUCA, the last universal common ancestor. There's the first cell, and that cell slowly evolved, and you had different branches of this magnificent tree of life. And the driving force behind this evolution is variations, which are being worked on by natural selection. You know, you can call it mutations instead of variations, doesn't really make a difference. So that's basically it, and that accounts for all of the diversity of life that, as we know it. Bait and switch. So here's two very simple pictures to understand bait and switch. Evolution is just a theory, like gravity. Okay, from what I've said now, you know evolution is an observation like gravity. There's nothing wrong with saying that. But gravity is an observation, and the theory to explain it is general relativity. Evolution is an observation, and the theory to explain it is the Darwinian mechanism, or the neo-Darwinian synthesis, whatever you want to call it. So these are two very different things. They have different epistemic weights. Of course they do. And you'll find something like this picture, sometimes deliberate, sometimes accidental, where someone might say, I see evolution happening in my lab. It's a fact. And he's talking about maybe something similar to Kettwell's, you know, peppered moth example. And the child's thinking, oh, he sees, you know, a small fish turning into a primate or something like that. Okay, I'm going to quickly go over some general biological problems for Darwinism. So the tree of life, according to the origin of species, was not a metaphor. It was a discovery. And this is another bait and switch that you're going to see neo-Darwinists use. When you speak about problems with the tree of life, they say, oh, that's actually a metaphor. It's not actually a discovery. It's not actually an observation. But to Darwin it was, and to most neo-Darwinists, it actually is. Now, horizontal gene transfer, something which was discovered in the 90s, this was something that really blurred out the tree idea in the minds of some biologists, even though most of them today still believe in the tree idea. The biologist Ford Doolittle, again another atheist, he published a paper, and I always hear this very ridiculous argument. Well, if you have a great argument against Darwinism, why don't you just publish in a peer-reviewed journal? And my answer is, well, why would I need to do that when Ford Doolittle and others have already done it? And the interesting thing is, most of the people who make this very ridiculous argument don't actually know the science. So what Ford basically concludes is the history of life cannot properly be represented as a tree. And together along with him, another atheist biologist, very well known for developing the field, is the biologist Carl Woese. We have the three domains of the tree of life, and he actually discovered the third domain. And he describes life more like a web than a tree. And this again shows you the inductive nature of science. The tree of life may have been taught as a fact in documentaries, in textbooks. You might have learned it as a fact when you were at school. Some biologists may still call it a fact. But as you can see, some biologists disagree because of new data, the problem of induction, the black swan example. We don't know what we don't know. It's not that we don't know something about something we know. It's the fact that we don't know something about what we don't know. We can get new data which is so novel, it creates a paradigm shift in our theories. So the geneticist Craig Venter, again another atheist, another well-known authority, he also says life is maybe like a bush, and the tree of life idea he thinks is outdated now. Okay, natural selection and mutations. Now, not all biologists agree that natural selection working on variations is the main driving force of evolution. Some believe it is not. Like the biologist Lynn Sagan, she won the National Medal of Science in America. She is, again, an atheist, so she's not going to have a religious bias. And this is exactly what she said. She says natural selection eliminates or maybe maintains. She proposes a completely different naturalistic mechanism. And, you know, also James Shapiro, he believes that this dominating idea of natural selection working on variations as the main driving force, this is an intellectual straitjacket. The gene-centered view. So what is the gene-centered view? The gene-centered view is that natural selection works at a gene level. And this was popularized by Richard Dawkins in the 1970s. Most people think he discovered it. He didn't. That was W.D. Hamilton. And since then, it's been taught as a fact. And this has been one of the main ideas in the modern synthesis, the gene-centered view. In 2010, the biologist E.O. Wilson, he published a paper. And in this paper, he challenged the gene-centered view. And they were going back and forth, and there was a lot of disagreement. And you know, E.O. Wilson, his book was reviewed by Dawkins, and Dawkins basically said, these are all the biologists which agree with me, and, you know, the multi-level selection idea of E.O. Wilson, it's not right, and so forth. And then E.O. Wilson said, well, the only disagreements I have is with real scientists, not journalists, right? So you have this back and forth, and according to some commentators in the field, the reputation of evolutionary biology here is at stake, because this is one of the central ideas. Now, I'm not going to make an argument for the gene-centered view is better than the multi-level selection or the other way around. All this example goes to show is there is an inductive nature of the science here. No matter how long the selfish gene idea or the gene-centered view idea was called a fact. The central dogma of molecular biology, as named by Francis Crick. Funnily enough, when someone asked him, about why he called it a dogma. He didn't actually know why. So this is something which was again accepted as a fact for a very long time in a published paper published in 2010. The biologist James Shapiro basically showed that it doesn't really hold anymore. There are some well-known exceptions. So that was just some general biological problems for evolution. And I chose those particular aspects of the modern synthesis, or the neo-Darwinian synthesis, because those are the most well-recognized. There are others as well, but the tree of life and natural selection working on variations and the gene-centered view and the central dogma are probably the most well-known. Sociological problems. So the idea that we are all deep down selfish, and that morality, self-restraint, civilization is just a veneer, is just a veil, and beneath that we are all selfish. And everything, including our communication, is actually manipulation. Manipulation for what end? When we mean selfishness, we don't just mean open-ended selfishness. We mean for your survival and reproduction, that every organism is out there for himself to survive and reproduce. And if that means at the cost of others, then so be it. We are deep down selfish. Now, there's some very visual problems with that. The very first thing is that we are, as human beings, kind. We have altruism. We have morality. We do have civilization. We do actually have hospitals, which is a very big monument to prove how the survival of the unfittest is the hallmark of humanity. So how do neo-Darwinists deal with the problem of selflessness? Well, they would say something like, well, there's kin selection. So I was reading in this book written by a very intelligent man who should know better, about, you know, this caveman. The caveman basically thinks to himself, well, I just found a tree here. So, you know, if I tell the other cavemen about this tree, then I'm less likely to survive because they'll get most of the food and there's a shortage of food. Oh, wait, they share my genes. So if I help them, I'm actually helping my own genes because they are my kin. That's my brother and that's my cousin. So they explain the fact that the caveman goes and tells the others about the tree because he actually cares about himself. So by telling them about the tree, he's actually being just as selfish as if he was just eating it all by himself. And the biologist J.B.S. Haldane, again, another very important figure in the modern synthesis, he said, I would lay down my life for two brothers or eight cousins. So you guys get the point here. So that's kin selection. That's the first way that neo-Darwinists would try to explain social behavior. The second is reciprocal altruism. So you don't really care about someone you're going to help. You're only helping them because one day they're going to help you, and that's going to help you survive and reproduce. So again, it's a selfish act. It looks selfless. Interesting. It's interesting how we don't know these things. We've actually got this veneer which is so thick we don't even know it ourselves. Now, both these ideas are not just challenged by multi-level selection of E.O. Wilson. There's also a very big problem in the sense that human behavior isn't like that. Which human being would say, yes, I'm helping this poor guy on the street because one day he's going to become rich and he's going to give me money? Oh, I'm actually helping, you know, my child, and I have this love for my child because they actually share my genes. And Dawkins writes in The Selfish Gene, you know, it is after all to a mother's benefit that her child is adopted, because then she can raise other children. But which mother thinks like that? So there's some very deep, profound problems with kin selection and reciprocal altruism as a ad hoc rationalization of human behavior. Now, just think of one thing. Many of us here, we give charity regularly. And when we give charity to, I don't know, charity X, How does the person, how does the recipient know that we gave him that, him or her that money? They don't. Most of the charity that we give online, the recipient doesn't know the individual that gave that £10 or £20. So how does that fit in kin selection? How does that fit in reciprocal altruism? So there's some very practical ways in which you know that there's some big problems for Darwinism here. Now I'm going to be going over some major problems in human evolution. Now, if you go back to the slide which I had right at the beginning, the slide was on, imagine if there's a lecturer who speaks about evolution, speaks about genetics, speaks about DNA, speaks about all these different things and fossils, and you at the end of it say, oh, well, I think a lot of this is very speculative, and I think it's based on assumptions. I think there's a lot of disputes. Now, most likely, they would be very upset at you using those sort of terms to describe evolution or Darwinism. But what terms do the textbooks use? And I mean the small print that you get before you get all the details. This is what the biologist Michael Kent says before he goes into human evolution. He speaks about it being very speculative, based on very little evidence, and it's not undisputed. And anyone can get access to academics and journals where you'll find biologists who do believe in Darwinism, who do believe in human evolution, speaking with these terms. And this book is not some anonymous book published by some guy who's been working in his mom's basement for 20 years. This is published by Oxford University. And he's a mainstream secular academic, and he's saying speculative based on little evidence, and it's not undisputed. And the biologist Henry Gee and others, again, mainstream secularists, they would say, you know, it's open to various interpretations. It's fragmentary, you know. And it's really sad when we are told something is a fact, and the very first thing that we should do is understand a fact in science is not the same thing as fact in our common language. But I applaud these biologists for being epistemically humble and saying, yeah, it is very speculative, and it is based on very little evidence. And as we're going to see, some of it is based, not some of it, it is actually based on a fundamental assumption. Now, the best way to visualize this assumption is in the early 20th century, there was a tooth that was found, and this tooth, from it, biologists thought that this is an early human ancestor. This is an ape man. And there was this picture drawn by an artist about this ape man. As you can see there, just from a tooth, they made this picture. He's there going out to club some, I don't know, zebras or something, and he's got someone next to him, perhaps his wife nagging him so that he goes out to work. He seems to have domesticated some animals in the background. Now, this tooth, this was actually not something which one biologist who was working in his mom's basement came out, wrote a paper and said, here's a picture and here's a tooth. This was published in Science, which is the second most prestigious journal in the world after Nature. So if someone says, oh, if you really believe something to be absolutely true, then get it peer-reviewed. Peer review is a beautiful process. It's a process that actually comes from the Islamic world, where the scientific method itself comes from, but it is not the absolute truth. Something being peer-reviewed means it's good science. It doesn't mean it's absolute, because nothing can be absolute in science. And this tooth, as some of you may know, was actually the tooth of a pig, which was mistakenly thought to be a human ancestor. Now, why did very intelligent biologists make up this huge story based upon this very little piece of evidence? And it's because of a fundamental assumption. And that fundamental assumption is that of naturalism, that every single thing that biologists study has naturalistic forces behind it, naturalistic factors behind it. The way Professor Gareth Nelson, again, another atheist biologist, well known, this is the way he puts it. We've got to have some ancestors. We'll pick those. Why? Because we know they have to be there, and these are the best candidates. Now, the really interesting thing is, the biologist Richard Lewontin from Harvard, he's again an atheist. He again, you know, believes in naturalism. He was reviewing Richard Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker. And, you know, Richard Dawkins speaks about the evolution of the wing in the bat and, you know, all these other things. And, you know, Francis Crick said, you know, save your soul and read this book, you know, The Blind Watchmaker. And Richard Lewontin, being who he is, he basically said, these are just soul stories, you know. They don't really have any basis. Yet in the same review, he actually made a very interesting admission. And that admission is that which Michael Ruse and other neo-Darwinists have actually admitted, which is that we are forced by our a priori assumption, meaning before experience assumption, that, you know, there has to be only materialism, only material causes. And that is actually a very interesting admission, that they say materialism, naturalism, is absolute. So they can't accept that human beings or something else came in the history of the world without there being prior naturalistic causes. So it doesn't matter if there are no fossils. It doesn't matter if there is no evidence for evolution at all. Just based upon classification of species, something like the Darwinian mechanism has to be true as a matter of logic from a naturalistic point of view. And this is not something which I just made up. This is actually even an admission made by Henry Gee in his book, Misunderstandings of Human Evolution. He's the senior editor of Nature, and on, I believe, page 32, he says, you know, even Charles Darwin, he said, you know, if there's no evidence for the Darwinian mechanism besides the classification of species, you know, that's enough. And interestingly, the classification of species, you know, how humans were put with primates and all this, this wasn't actually done by Darwin. This was done by a Linnaeus, who believed in God. So he didn't look at all the similarities and say, therefore evolution is true. He believed in God and he believed in metaphysical causes. But if you already come to data with the baggage of naturalism, with the assumption of methodological naturalism, something like the Darwinian mechanism, the Darwinian history of life, has to be true as a matter of logic. And the philosopher of science, Michael Ruse, he actually admitted to this. And this is not something which some really honest academics try to hide behind. They would admit it. So I'm just going to go over some alternative theories when it comes to evolution. And the reason why I'm going to come up with, explain these, is simply to show it's all valid within science. Because remember, any set of data can support many different theories. It's not deductive. Any set of data can fit many different theories. Now, if you have a naturalistic theory, it's science. If you have something which is non-naturalistic, it's not science by definition. So panspermia is the idea that life was seeded on Earth. Because remember, even if you go back to the first cell is very complicated, right? It's not something which you can say, oh, the first cell, it's just protoplasm, it's nothing really. It's actually something very complicated. So very intelligent biologists like Francis Crick, he proposed maybe life, you know, evolved somewhere else and was seeded on Earth by, you know, extraterrestrial beings, aliens, perhaps. You know, this is something which other biologists also think possible, right? Now, that's allowed within the framework of naturalism. So if someone turns around and says to you, oh, you know, you believe in intelligent design, say to them, well, so does Francis Crick, but a naturalistic type of intelligent design. Then there's the aquatic ape theory put forth by the biologist Sir Alistair Hardy. And if you remember right in the beginning, I spoke about Darwinism as a philosophy and the social pressure behind it. The really interesting thing is this biologist, who didn't believe in God, you know, he waited something like 30 years to publish his aquatic ape theory, or the waterside theory, which is a radical idea which challenged the conventional idea of human evolution. And the reason why he waited 30 years is because he thought he was going to get, you know, mocked by his colleagues. And the social pressure in the scientific community forced him not to publish for 30 years. Now, when he finally published, they did mock him. And it was very difficult for him. And what he basically proposed is this. There's many different things about human beings which can't be explained if we just stick to the conventional theory that we have a common ancestor with the apes, which came down from the trees, slowly became bipedal. He believes we became bipedal, as in walking on two, in water. If you take a chimp, and by the way, I'm not endorsing this act, but if you take a chimp and you throw it in water, it's going to sink to the bottom like a brick. But if you put a human baby, it's going to swim. We have certain features which are very different to other primates. We have webbing. We have, we're mostly hairless. So we have these features, and because of these features, he proposed the aquatic ape theory. Again, under naturalism, nothing wrong with believing human beings were mermaid-like things for maybe a couple of million years, a couple of hundred thousand years. Then there's the pig-chimp hybrid theory, hypothesis put forth by the geneticist Eugene McCarthy. And what he basically says is this. He says, certain things about human beings do not make sense if we are purely linked to other primates. He believes there must have been some sort of breeding with a pig, between a pig and a chimp, and that created the human line. And his logic is, I mean, he has a few reasons he gives for this proposal, but, you know, the human heart is very similar to a pig. You know, gorillas, chimpanzees, they have a penis bone. Humans don't have a penis bone. So a lot of other reasons, and he basically says, you know, he believes in the pig-chimp hypothesis, and most biologists would say, no, you know, this is nonsense. There is no pig in our family. But the reason why I'm showing these examples is to show all of them are valid, and they're scientific, because they fall under naturalism. And Francis Crick put it in a very interesting way. He said, biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see is not designed, but rather evolved. Now, the first thing I want to speak about is there's a thing which is always thrown around a lot, but there's not enough of them, apparently. It's actually fossils. Fossils are very rare, and fossilization is very rare. And when you get this picture of, you know, we have these nice fossils which show a transition between an ape-like creature to a human-like creature, and we split from the other primates about 7 million years ago. Fossils are very, very rare. So for someone to make the claim that we have fossils and this proves evolution, they've misunderstood how rare fossils actually are. In a paper published in Science, one biologist described it as working out the plot of War and Peace with 13 randomly selected pages. Now, War and Peace, for those of us who, you know, haven't read it, I haven't read it, but what I do know is it has over 500,000 words, right? So it's a big book. So that analogy goes to show you what problems there are when it comes to fossils and trying to put together a story using them. And this whole idea of a missing link, it's very popular. It's used by, you know, even people who we sometimes consider to be mainstream scientists. But there's some big problems. If you imagine you get these very famous YouTube clips where somebody's taking a picture of themselves every single day for like 20 years, 15 years, you see a nice gradual change And every single picture, if you imagine, is like a fossil. So you get a nice change over, you know, 10 years or 15 years, or in this case, 2 years. And if you imagine those pictures that you have from which you make the video, if there's, I don't know, 2-3 days missing, maybe a week missing, you may call that the missing link. But with the fossil record, we had the exact opposite. We firstly do not know, and we can't say with percentage, how many organisms or how many species there actually are. So the philosopher of biology, John Wilkins, another atheist secularist, he says, you know, there could be potentially millions of missing species that we don't even know about. There could be, you know, an indefinite number of missing branches. What we have is random snapshots. Between the time of, say, something like the Lucy-like ancestor and a anatomically modern human, us, there is a couple of million years. You'd need millions of fossils to make a nice transition. Now, we're not expecting neo-Darwinists to have that, because fossilization is very rare. It's like, you could say it's like lightning hitting an area. But what's important is, if you are going to make a story based upon very little evidence and assumptions, and which is speculative, no problem. There's nothing wrong with doing that, as long as you are open about the fact that there are assumptions and it is very speculative. Henry Gee, in his book, Misunderstandings of Human Evolution, and in Deep Time and other books, he puts it in a very colorful way. He says, look, no fossil is buried with it, with a birth certificate. So to take a line of fossils and say, you know, this is the ancestor of this and this is the ancestor of this, he says, look, this is not even a scientific hypothesis. It's a bedtime story. And in his book, he draws a imaginary tree of life. And on the imaginary tree of life, he plots random fossils. He's very careful, and he admits this, to not putting the fossils at the branching points, because we don't have enough information. Then what he does is he takes these random fossils and he draws a line, that's line A, then he draws another line, radically different, line B, and another line, radically different, line C, and he says all of these are equally valid and you can't actually say one is more valid than the other. And how many lines can you get from a plot? An indefinite number. So he does believe in neo-Darwinism. He does believe in human evolution. But what's really interesting about him, as opposed to Richard Dawkins and Jerry Coyne and others, is he's very honest about just how speculative this is. So when someone turns around, and I've heard these stupid things, oh, evolution is deductive because you can take a line of fossils, there you go. Well, according to Henry Gee and others, you can't take any fossil and say for sure this is a human ancestor. Although he believes, like Gareth Nelson mentioned previously, there has to be human ancestors because he is a naturalist. Okay, again, Gareth Nelson, he puts it in the same way. He says, you know, to go to the fossil record and to try and take a line of fossils and say, you know, this is a descendant of this, you know, it's an illusion. But, and this is a very important thing, and this is the admission that he makes, and something which other people bank on. It sounds very authoritative. We have the fossils. I think it's actually quite deceiving to do that. And as we're going to see in a few examples, there is sometimes very big deception going on the macro level, if you want to call it that. Now, I'm just going to go back to my point of classification. You know, Linnaeus put together all of the living world as he saw it into categories. He didn't automatically deduce evolution from it and say this evolved from this and there's common ancestors. But this is something which you would have to do as a matter of logic if you subscribe to naturalism. Something like the Darwinian mechanism or Darwinian evolution has to be true. Now, so this particular point about human-chimp DNA similarity 99% is irrelevant from that point, because we know whether you look at it physically or you look at it from a DNA perspective, obviously there's going to be similarities because there's physical similarities. But to say because there's a similarity between a human and a chimp, therefore that necessarily proves that they have a common ancestor. This argument doesn't work, but I'm just going to give this example. Since 1975, the experiment done by King and Wilson, this idea of 99% has been thrown around, right? That there's 99% similarity between humans and chimps, and this proves common ancestry. Now, like I mentioned before, even if it was 99%, it doesn't necessarily prove human-chimp ancestry. And if that's not enough for you, pick up a book, Evolution, The Logic Behind the Science by the philosopher of science, Elliot Sober, published by Cambridge University Press. And he goes over this particular point. He says, you know, it doesn't necessarily, you know, humans and mushrooms are different. Therefore, they don't have a common ancestor, and humans and chimps are similar. Therefore, they must have a common ancestor. He says this isn't necessarily true. What's really interesting about this 99% is, even if it was true, like I said, it doesn't prove common ancestry. What's really interesting is, in a paper published by John Cohen, and you know, he cites other biologists, they basically say, because of missing DNA, extra genes, altered connections in gene networks, and very structure of chromosomes, it's actually very hard to work out humanness and chimpness. In fact, you can't even calculate properly a percentage difference between any two living organisms. And the geneticist Savante Pabo, a chimp consortium member based in Germany, when he was asked about this, he says, look, you know, I don't think there's any way to calculate a number. But what he says is, look, at the end of the day, it's a cultural, social, and political way that we see our differences. So what this goes to show is, when you find a very proud neo-Darwinist or atheist wearing 99%, you can say two things to them. 99% chimp, I mean, the shirt. Firstly, to claim that 99%, assuming it's true, is proof of common ancestry, that's based on the assumption of naturalism. Two, it's not even 99%. In fact, what the biologists did, if you imagine, you would think 99% was calculated in this way. Take out the chimp genome, human genome, 99% similarity, right? That's not what they did. They actually compared both of them. They saw 2.4 billion letters which are similar. They saw 1.3 billion letters which were different. They decided to ignore the 1.3 billion letters and only compare what was left over, and they calculated the 99%. Now you're going to think that's nuts. Why on earth did they do that? But that's actually, there's nothing wrong with doing that, because what they did is they assumed common ancestry between humans and chimps is true. So all of the differences in the DNA, the 1.3 billion letters, they said, let's ignore that. There's nothing wrong with that, because their assumption is that common ancestry is true. But what circular reasoning is when you take that 99% and you say this is proof of common ancestry, because the 99% was calculated, even though some are arguing that it's false now, some biologists, it was based upon the assumption of common ancestry. So to use it for proof of common ancestry is circular reasoning. Okay, a very famous fossil, this fossil when, you know, Obama went to Eritrea or Ethiopia, I forgot which one, and, you know, he touched the bones of this ancient hominoid, this ancient human ancestor. And as we know, even though this is shown to be a missing link, we know there's no such thing as a missing link now. I hope we know that now. And the interesting thing is, if you look at the fossils, according to mainstream secular academics, they would say this is a fossil of an ape or a chimp. Even Donald Johanson had his or her, we're not sure if she's male or female, we only have 40% of the fossils. Even he said, you know, it's pretty much an ape. What's interesting about this fossil find is, according to the pelvis bone, some biologists have said it shows signs that this creature was bipedal, meaning walking on twos. Okay, does that mean it's definitely a human ancestor? Of course not, because we don't have the fossils in between. But assuming, let's ignore that. Assuming it was bipedal, and according to other biologists, we don't actually understand its motion. We can't say for sure. Some say it knuckle walked. Some say it definitely wasn't bipedal. Some say it was bipedal. But let's assume it's bipedal. We know of an ape that was discovered 10 million year old fossil in Italy, which was a fully bipedal, meaning walking on two legs, ape. And paleontologists know this ape has nothing to do with human ancestry. So this very popular fossil, when you actually look at the science, is based on assumptions, and there's very little there. But like I mentioned right near the beginning, there is more with Darwinism than the science. And this is admitted by the critics of Darwinism and also the proponents of Darwinism. Now look at the feet of this representation of Lucy. Those are very human-like feet. Chimps have opposable thumbs. That's why they can peel bananas using their feet. But those feet look very human-like. Can you see the feet in the fossils? They're not there. Her hands are not long and curved fingers like a chimp would have, like an ape would have. It's actually very human-like hands, small hands. Can you see the hands in the fossil? Now, you may think, okay, those are irrelevant points, okay? Because we know it's not a human ancestor for sure because of all the other reasons, methodological naturalism, we don't have the fossils and so forth. But the reason why I'm pointing this out is what I mentioned in the beginning. We're dealing with more than science here. We're dealing with a philosophical worldview as well, intertwined. I have absolutely no problem with the science. I'm happy to accept Darwinian mechanism as a working model. I don't really have an issue with that, and I don't think anyone should have an issue with that. I have an issue, and likewise, philosophers of science have an issue when you claim certainty on an idea, and when you're not honest about the assumptions behind it, and the fact that there is actually a lot of philosophy involved. 2009, this very famous fossil, Ida. This was shown all over the world. There was books on this. There was documentaries on this. This came on the History Channel. It came on, you know, many different channels, and it was translated into different languages. Google, 2009, put this famous fossil Ida on its front page. And just for the sake of amusement, I put Ida fossil in Google. And it is the most famous fossil you can imagine. Almost 500,000 hits on this fossil. The paleontologist John Hume, he said about this fossil, it's the scientific equivalent of the Holy Grail. It's going to be taught in the textbooks for the next 100 years. David Attenborough said, you know, it's not a matter of imagination, it's not a matter of suggestions, it's fact, it's true, this is a human ancestor. And after all the press, you know, circus, and that's the words Henry Gee uses for it, after all that was over, and after all the dust settled, and the millions of people were exposed to this human ancestor, in a journal, Nature, it was concluded Ida has nothing to do with human ancestry. So the reason why I brought this up is to show the level of propaganda, the level of social pressure, marketing behind the Darwinian mechanism. Now, one of the proofs of evolution, of the Darwinian mechanism, is the idea of vestigial organs. Now, like I mentioned previously, some things which are put forth as fact, like all biologists have consensus on these things, this is not necessarily the case. One of the things that we hear a lot is the coccyx, it's a vestigial organ, it's absolutely useless. You don't need it. Well, I would say, okay, fine. If you believe the coccyx is a absolutely useless organ, take it out. I'll take you to the monument of the survival of the unfittest. I'll take you to the hospital. I'll pay for it. Get it removed. Have a seat. If you're not willing to put your back side online with an argument, then don't open your mouth. If you believe this to be a vestigial organ, take it out. You'll find you won't be able to sit down. This does actually have some function. Now, I'm not saying that the people who propose this idea of vestigial organs are all mad or something, right? All I'm going to show is that there are some fundamental assumptions behind this. And because of those assumptions, you have this confirmation bias, and whatever you see, you really believe this is evidence. The appendix is often cited as a vestigial, and maybe it can be. Charles Darwin, in his book, he spoke about it being a vestigial organ. But just a few years ago, the appendix, in a paper that was published, they were explaining about appendix basically flushing the system with good bacteria. So it does have some function. Now, they may say, well, goosebumps, there's another thing. No problem. All this goes to show you is the inductive nature of science. And a biologist, Stephen Scadding, he basically, even though he does believe in the Darwinian mechanism, he doesn't believe vestigial organs to be any special evidence of Darwinism. Now, what's really interesting is, look, the main thing you can take away from this slide, on the very least, when it comes to vestigial organs, is it's not a sealed deal the way that it's actually taught. A very interesting example of the inductive nature of science is the idea that most of the human genome is junk. Now, Francis Crick was very adamant about most of the genome being junk. And he said, you shouldn't even obsessively hunt for its function. Now, I don't have a problem when biologists say most of the human genome is junk. And I wouldn't really ever had a problem with Francis Crick saying that. All I would add is, maybe you'll discover something in the future which will go to show what you consider junk may not be actually junk. Remember, there's many different interpretations of the same data. The philosopher Darwinist Philip Kitcher, the way he put it is, a lot of the DNA in there is not needed, it's junk. If it's intelligently designed, then God needs to go back to school. Now, this is where it's getting dangerous, because you're taking a scientific idea, and science is based on induction, and its conclusions can change, and you're using that to make theological points. Do we go to philosophers of science and biologists to learn about theology, metaphysics? Why is it in the most prestigious journal in the world, Nature, David Hull, he writes about the God of the, evolution, and he speaks about so much suffering and evil in the world? If you're reading that article, you would expect to go to a journal and read about biology. We don't go to biologists for metaphysical implications. Who does that? What's really interesting about this idea of 97% of the human genome being junk, besides being used, for so long as an absolute fact, recently, in the last couple of years, in the studies that were published by the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, this study, basically, what they were saying was most of the genome is not junk. In a book published by the biologist Nessa Carey last year, she also speaks about, that we now know that some of this stuff can have very big impact. So all my basic point, if you don't remember anything from today, is anything that's shown as a scientific fact, remember, scientific facts can change. They're based on induction. So don't take a scientific fact and make theological, metaphysical, absolute implications of that. So what's basically going on in biology? According to the biologist Michael Rose, in an article about, what Darwin got wrong or something like this, he basically said, look, the complexity of biology is similar to quantum mechanics, right? What's really important here is this idea that Darwin came along 150 years ago and everything was nice and clear, and from his time till now, the only people who reject his theory are religious people, and there's no disputes, there's no speculations, there's no assumptions, there's no naturalistic rivals. A lot of this idea is just propaganda. And if you already have a philosophical assumption of naturalism, then something like the Darwinian story has to be true. I mean, just take a very simple example. In the 1912 or something, 1900s, European explorers, when they were in part of Africa, they found this man, the name Otabanga, and you know, they were quite ruthless. They killed his family, they killed his children, and he was a very short black African man, and they said, this is the ape human, right? And they took him to New York, they put him in a human zoo, and you know, when some colored people, as they were known back then, when they went and they tried to get him released, the reply was, the colored reverend must understand evolution is as debatable as the multiplication table. You're not going to challenge the multiplication table, are you? Now, the reason why I'm bringing up this example is to show you confirmation bias. If you really believe something to be true because of your philosophical ideas, then anything, even a short black guy, is going to start looking like evidence for human evolution. Now, Otabanga, I'm not saying all biologists believed he was a human. I'm just showing the confirmation bias and the social pressure at that time about how true the Darwinian story actually was. Now, what can we as Muslims do? Well, we as Muslims or Christians or Jews or humans can do is the same thing any rational, logical human being would do. We don't need to have a special provision because of our beliefs. The philosopher David Stove, he writes in his book that, you know, the Darwinian explanation of evolution, even though it's the best one available, is not true. Now, we can make the same conclusion. We can say, yeah, we'll accept all the science. We can observe evolution. We can, you know, someone says, do you believe in evolution? Say, yeah, I can see evolution, right? And we can accept it as a working model. And upon false working models, you can even discover things like phlogiston. You can discover things that actually work. We went to the moon based upon Newtonian mechanics, but Newtonian laws aren't universal. They break down at the quantum level. So science can work even though it's wrong, and this is well known in the philosophy of science. Now, further reading, just to get into, and again, these are some of these, well, most of these books are actually popular books. So if you really want to get a entry-level understanding of the mechanics, the inductive nature of evolutionary science, here's some books which I recommend. James Shapiro's book, A View from the 21st Century, he believes that we're nearly at a point at a paradigm shift in evolution. Evolution, the extended synthesis, this is a spin on the modern synthesis of the 1930s, and, you know, I believe something like 12 academics in this book, they basically go over ideas that don't fit within the neo-Darwinian synthesis. Lynn Sagan's Acquiring Genomes, A Theory of the Origin of Species, she believes in a different mechanism of evolution. Then there is Darwinian Fairy Tales by the philosopher of science David Stove. He speaks about the issues from a sociological point of view, the epigenetics revolution. We used to think you couldn't inherit acquired characteristics, but now there is a almost resurrection of a type of Lamarckism. And What Darwin Got Wrong by Jerry Fodor and Massio Patimi Palmari, and The Accidental Species by Henry Gee. Now, what's so important about all these books is they're not written by religious people, they're written by mainstream secular academics who are atheists, and they're respected within their fields. If you don't think that science is revisable, and that the, you know, you're doubting whether the evolutionary biology is an inductive field, just have a read of those books. So my main points, which I mentioned right at the beginning, science is revisable, meaning all of its conclusions can change. The Darwinian mechanism is not an exception, and I went over some of the problems for Darwinism. Now, someone may turn around and say, yeah, but this particular problem that you mentioned about epigenetics or junk DNA or fossils or whatever, you could say every single point that I made there in terms of biology and sociology and all the rest, new data can come that even that stuff can change. So everything that I said in terms of biology can be wrong. What does that mean? It doesn't change the argument, because the argument I'm making today is just a very simple logical argument. Science is revisable. Darwinism is not an exception. Now, if you're going to claim it's an exception, you're making it into pseudoscience. You're making it into, you know, Freudian psychoanalysis. If there are no problems for the Darwinian mechanism, let's assume there's no problems for the Darwinian mechanism at all. From the time of Darwin till now, we've had a nice smooth ride. There was no eclipse of Darwinism. There are no biologists like Richard Goldschmidt and people who come up with theories like hopeful monsters. And there was no disagreement in the biological community. Everyone believed in the Darwinian mechanism. Say this is the way history was. Does that change the logic of the argument? It doesn't. Science is revisable, and the Darwinian mechanism is not an exception. So just to summarize, if you take an orthodox understanding of the beginning of life, creation, as a Muslim, of course there's going to be a conflict between that and neo-Darwinism. But you can accept it as a working model, because we have reasons to believe in science, but we know that scientific conclusions can change. We have reasons to believe in the Quran, independent reasons. So if there's a conflict between the two, we'll go with what's certain, which is the Quran. Now, that doesn't mean you discard science or its conclusions, but you understand the reason why science is powerful, the reason why it works, and the reason why it's changed the world is not what very ridiculous statements which come out of the mouths of people who should know better, that science gives absolute truth and you're an idiot if you don't accept Darwinism. It's because scientific conclusions can change. If Einstein was told, no, you can't come up with your special theory of relativity, no, you can't come up with general theory of relativity because Newton was right and it's worked for 250 years, where would physics be now? We know that the history of science shows all scientific conclusions can change, and the philosophy of science shows why. And like I mentioned right near the beginning, and I gave some reasons for that, Darwinism is much more than a scientific theory or a model for some people. Therefore, I mean, the way I think about it is this, you can call it a atheistic creation story, because there is a creator, a unseen creator, working behind the scenes, an unseen blind watchmaker. And like Dawkins said, you know, Darwin allowed atheists to be intellectually satisfied. So if you get this very emotional reaction when you speak about Darwinism, you can understand why, because that's their worldview. What we as Muslims should do is just engage with them and explain that, you know, science can change, and you need to understand that just because something works doesn't mean it's absolutely true. So just to summarize, I started with the name of God. God has the picture. We as human beings have the pixel. We have the fragmentary knowledge. So if there's sometimes a conflict between the two, it's not really an issue, because you can accept something to be science and inductive and work within that framework, and you can still hold on to your religious beliefs. There is no conflict. There is no fool's choice this way or that way. Everything good that I've said is from God, the Creator, and every mistake has been my own. I thank you very much for listening. Jazakallah khair. Assalamu alaikum.